Strategic Christian Services, in association with Dominion Enterprises, is pleased to present Let's Talk, Communication Skills for People Who Want Healthy Relationships, with Dennis Peacock. This is Lesson 3, entitled Growing Relationships Are Built on the Process of Mutual Transformation, Part 2.
Hi, I'm Dennis Peacock in the ongoing series of Let's Talk, dealing with communication skills to give us deeper relationships and succeed, basically, in life, because life is about relationships. And we're trusting that what we're saying is helpful to you. And again, we're also assuming that those of you that are really hearing what we're saying and want to go deeper will contact us at our website or the phone number that's on your screen. Bless you. Okay, well, the audience continues to change here. I assume the people that are watching this know that this is a stacked deck of friends and people that have heard a lot of this stuff. But you can never hear it that much. Again, every time I teach it, you know, I'm learning a lot of new stuff. Just by way of information, this material, the first time I taught it was over 2 years ago, and I've really waited until now to re-record it because as I've, you know, working on living it out, it continues to change and grow and be modified by life experience, let alone my wife, who is wonderfully quiet here, but not at home, I might add. We are looking here in this lesson on dealing some more with principles around strongholds. And the reason I'm putting so much energy into strongholds is everybody is able to have a pretty good relationship until you run into a stronghold. And then the question is, can you get over that mountain? Can you, you know, find a way around it or through it or underneath it that allows the relationship to go to a new level? And by the way, it's the things that we cannot talk about that define our relationships. I want to say that again. It's the things that we cannot talk about that define our relationships. And I used the analogy, and I'll use it again, of stuffing things under the rug. Over the years, when I've got involved in marriage counseling, Jan or I, or I myself, in dealing with relationships, what you end up with is somebody brings a relationship to you that is a rug literally filled with things that were strongholds that they stuffed under the rug because they couldn't deal with them. And then you end up with a relationship where there's so many things you can't talk about, it's like maneuvering your way through a minefield. Now, it's interesting because I travel a lot on airplanes and what have you. You cannot help but overhear people in conversations. And once you're into this stuff and get a listening ear, you hear strongholds popping up all the time and manipulation popping up all the time in their communication. And you can tell they've hit something, they stuffed under the rug. They're still trapped in the neuroses of thinking that they can solve it if they just say it another way or say it with more hate or more anger or more fear or more manipulation or whatever. And then the relationship deteriorates into something that is really a nightmare. And all of us have experienced that kind of thing to some degree. And again, Let's Talk is about how to get the stuff out from underneath the rug, get around it, and get into a deeper level of life and love and relationship with people that we're relating to. Well, let's talk a little bit more specifically about strongholds and our ability to give up our strongholds. All of us have them. In order to get free of strongholds, and I want to talk a little bit, again, this is long subject, books, we don't have that kind of time here. Where do we get strongholds? Some strongholds are inherited. The scripture says that the sins or the iniquities of the fathers are passed on to the children down to the third and the fourth generation. Our families have genetic tendencies both in the natural and in the psychological or the spiritual. And we inherit the tendencies of our family lines. Now, in particular, where that plays out in a very obvious way is when you listen to the way that your parents handled disputes, they were teaching you, for good or ill, how to handle disputes. They were teaching you how to handle strongholds, for good or ill. We are instructed by the relationships that we've been exposed to, for good or ill, as I was saying a moment ago. And that one's really obvious. But there are, again, in the same way that we have those genetic tendencies, any doctor is going to tell you that the reason they do the family history when you go for a checkup is that is what the doctors, the medical community say, is the single most important determinative factor about certain diseases as to whether or not your parents had it, et cetera, et cetera. And that's true in the spirit. So strongholds are inherited generationally. The second way that we get them is we appropriate them from other people through peer pressure or mimicking somebody else. Jan and I had a discussion with all three of our kids at one point or another when they went into the teenage years, and we explained to them very carefully, and Adam and Catherine, who are here, would verify this. We said, you know, we know you're going into your teenage years. We know there's a thing called peer pressure. We believe in peer pressure, and we are your peers. You know, we're not interested in you following some, you know, airheaded teenager into stupidity and, you know, those kind of values that they have, where they got them and why they think they're workable is a science in and of itself. But the point is, when people especially are in the formative years of their personality, we borrow things that we admire from other people. And in that situation, we may be, in fact, borrowing a stronghold. We may be borrowing a manipulative device. I've seen young men do that, for example. You know, if somebody's manipulative device of a male is anger and physical confrontation, and it seems to work for them, then that's what you do. So we do bring these things on ourselves. Or, thirdly, stronghold is something that we may have taken on in our own devices. We saw that a certain thing appeared to be working, or we were afraid of a certain feeling or a certain set of thoughts that we had, and we developed strongholds to protect those thoughts or those feelings from ever coming out into the light and being dealt with. And again, from a Christian point of view, I remind us of 1 John chapter 1, verse 7, where it says, if we walk in the light as He is in the light. And the whole issue of exposing, again, our inner fears, our inner conversations, et cetera, to the right people and getting those things out for examination keeps a stronghold from developing. Strongholds grow in the dark, and that is why they must be exposed. And again, we're back in the whole question of who do you do that with appropriately. You know, we're not talking about walking up to a stranger and say, you know, do you know I have suicidal thoughts? Or are you aware I'm not clear on my sexuality? Or are you aware that I have a problem with stealing? Or whatever the thing might be. We're talking about doing that in the appropriate relationships. Well, there's 5 points here I want to bring up on the issue of strongholds. And let me say one more introductory comment about that before we go in it. It's a phrase that I'm not sure whether I got it from my dear friend Ron Coverson, who is somebody that I've worked with this material or others on, but it's a phrase that we use called standing in the pain of the question. Now, one of the things that we don't want to do, we don't like to do in our quest to be comfortable, is when a really painful question comes up that demands us to examine something in ourselves we don't want to examine. We get out of that question as quick as we can, and we get angry with anybody who's taken us into that question. And if we're going to be committed to a relationship of transformation rather than a relationship of performance, and if we're committed to growing, we need to be committed to standing in the pain of questions we don't want to stand in until we get answers. And if we're going to get free, if we're going to repent, to use the Christian word, if we're going to get free of things we need to get free from, there's going to be pain involved. Jan brought the point up here in the last session that we Christians have this idea that God is going to magically change all the things that are wrong with us, you know, by this experience or that experience. I see believers going from meeting to meeting to meeting, hoping that they will get change in a meeting instead of having to stand in the pain of the question or be vulnerable with people in their lives who can help them change. They'd rather have it happen in an instant, in an event, rather than a process. And thank God that does happen on occasion. And that's called miracles or interventions from God. But the standard line of the way God changes things is by the process of growth and the willingness for us to stand in the pain of the question. Exhibit A would be Christ standing in the pain of the crucifixion. Thank God he had the courage to do that. Okay? So, the first question we need to ask ourselves when we see a strong emotional response either in us or Russ, if I see you and I have been friends for years, if we're interacting. And by the way, let's put this in an authority context. Let's suppose that you're an authority figure in my life from a structural thing. You're a boss or you're a pastor or you're a parent. Okay, we can play all that out. In order for us to have a deep relationship, again, we have to define this relationship on our willingness to be able to share with one another what we see. One of the rules of our relationship with our kids that we had, and I think they would tell you this, is that when we were wrong, when Jan or I were wrong, or when we saw that our behavior, our speech was inappropriate, from the time they were little kids, we'd ask their forgiveness. We would say, you know, Adam, I know that what I said, the way I responded wasn't right. Will you forgive me? And what it actually does is it bonds relationships in authority structures rather than tears them down. We got far, far too many leaders who think that if they admit to sin, admit to error, admit to strongholds, that they're somehow going to lose their authority when in fact the exact opposite is the truth. Knowing how to respond properly so that we can elicit the right response from an authority figure is another issue altogether. But let's pretend that you're my pastor, you're my boss, and when I see a stronghold in you, that is, I see the evidence of heightened emotions, I feel anger, I feel manipulation, I feel intimidation, I feel whatever game you're now playing on me. And by the way, we could be talking about husbands and wives. I've done this with Jan in my immaturity. Wives do it to husbands. Parents do it to kids. We use our power in the relationship to intimidate instead of to enlighten or to bring them into greater truth. But if I see a stronghold, emotional stronghold manipulation, I need to stop and say, Russ, the ground rules of our relationship are we want to mutually change. Can I share with you? I'm appealing to you to share something that I feel is cutting off our communication. Okay? And that's the beauty of going back to what we talked about in the first lesson here in Let's Talk, which is the need to define the nature of our relationship. And if we want a growing relationship, we have to have a mutual agreement that it doesn't matter about the authority structure. We recognize the validity of authority structures. Everything that God builds has authority structures or hierarchy in it. But the relationship has got to have an agreement that regardless of the hierarchy, we can appeal to one another, especially when we see that a stronghold may be hindering us or keeping us from our ability to really communicate and build a deeper relationship. So the question then that I would ask you, or you would ask me, or Jan would ask me, or I'd ask Adam, or anybody else in this room is, let's say you confront me. I've got a heightened emotion, you feel manipulation, you feel me doing something that's backing this conversation back down. The question for me that you need to ask me, and then I need to stand in that question is, what idea or view of myself am I defending right now? What is it that I think I need to defend? And that is the first question. What am I defending? Dennis, Jan can say this to me, your voice inflection went up, you got angry, I felt you back me off, I felt this, I felt that. I'm asking you the question. Now, if I'm really committed to growth, I'm not going to play the authority card on Jan, woman, submit, I'm your husband, blah, blah, or any of that kind of nonsense. I'm going to say, yep, our prior agreement has been when we detect strongholds operating in the relationship, we're going to do a timeout, we're going to back off and say, okay, if you see that going on in me, what is it that I'm working on? Jan and I had a situation here a couple of months ago where I hit a stronghold. And I wasn't able to get through it in the conversation. It involved some other people. But we talked a lot about it for weeks afterwards. as to what was that, because I had all the symptoms of hitting something that is a major hindrance to my growth. The second question that we ask is, what does this idea or what does this view of myself promise me in terms of protection? Because a stronghold has almost got a life of its own. It promises us that if we stand behind it, it will protect us or serve us in some kind of a practical way. For example, if I'm still in the performance game, my strongholds protect me from having to admit that I'm wrong. My strongholds keep me trapped in the blame game so that I don't have to deal with whatever's wrong with me, because for whatever reason, I don't accept correction well, because correction means rejection. And we're going to talk about that diagram up there here a little later on in this lesson. Instead of being corrected, when people corrected me, my parents corrected me or whatever, they rejected me, they pushed me away instead of bringing me correction in a way that helped free me and see that correction is a liberating thing, it's a freeing thing, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card properly played than something that makes me feel really bad about myself. And a stronghold feeds off that kind of a situation. It tells us that it will protect us from rejection or feeling pain. Okay? Third question. What do I stand to gain or lose if I alter this idea? Now, there's a 10-cent word, no pun intended, called a paradigm. Okay? A paradigm is a pair of nickels. I just ruined the thing. But a paradigm is a 10-cent word that talks about a mindset that we have or a particular view of reality. And if I'm in a stronghold, that stronghold has a view of reality that I have to give up if I'm going to change and get free, if I'm going to experience genuine transformation. So when we hit a stronghold, what is happening is we are going to have to give up an idea or a view of reality, which is probably connected with a set of emotions, because we're relatively complex that way. Ideas are fueled by emotions. They're strengthened by emotions. Our emotions stand behind the thoughts that we have. I have to ask myself, okay, if Russ is confronting me and I see that I'm in this stronghold reaction, I'm in pain, but I refuse to get off the griddle. I'm not going to play some cheap shot of, yeah, but Russ, what about you? And by the way, you know, I've seen you do the same thing that you're correcting me for, which is another way of trying to get out of the pain of the question. If I'm committed to transformation and ultimately committed to our relationship and want to fulfill the agreement that we want a growing relationship without mountains under the rug, and I'm in that, if I'm in the game and on my game, I'm going to say, okay, what is this thing? What is this idea that I'm experiencing in here, if I get in touch with it? What is it saying to me? What is that about? Now, let me say, you may not be able to get a hold of whatever that stronghold is within the conversation. And if you can't, the agreement is, okay, I want to pray about this. I want to work on this. I don't get it yet, but I see that I got a stronghold operating here. And I promise you, because of the nature of our relationship, that I'm going to work on that until I can figure that out. And if you get something, will you please pray about it? Because I want to get free. It's clear it's a hindrance, and I recognize by my emotional responses that there is something here, and it's real, and I want to get out of it. Okay. So then I got to ask myself the question, what do I win or lose? What do I stand to gain if I get rid of it? Fourthly, and I just shared that really in what I just said, what do I need to pray against? And here's another question, who is going to hold me accountable for what I've now experienced of this stronghold? Because two of us can do what one of us never do. And some of you have heard my story about in athletics. I played football at Cal Berkeley, and I had a guy named Tyrone. I won't use his last name. I hope he's still alive. But when we do what we called fire drills at the end of the practice, the backs, and I was a running back, the backs would all run with each other up and down the field, and One particular day we did, I think, 22 of them after practice on a really hot day. We were all dying, and the only reason we were able to do it is because the idiot next to us kept running. And the internal conversation was, if you're stupid enough to still do this, I guess I'm going to have to run with you. And there's a living out of the principle, two are better than one. Two of us can hold, in holding each other accountable, we have more power than we do if we try and do things on our own. So the question then becomes, okay, who am I going to let hold me accountable? And Russ, since I used you as a starting point in this illustration, if you and I both seem a stronghold and you don't know what it is and I don't know what it is, but we know it's there, then I need to be accountable to you in the sense of the process of, I want to stay in this until I figure out what it is. And whatever insight you get, help me, and I'll do the same for you, okay? Number five is similar to that. Who can I make an agreement with to work with me, to keep me maintaining the freedom that I've just discovered? Because getting rid of a stronghold is really like a deliverance, if I can use that word. We come out of something that's powerfully worked in our life, and old habits die hard. You know, and that's why, for example, when you have a tree, you stake that tree up and put the rubber stuff around it until that tree naturally grows straight on its own. And that's the way that we live when we've experienced deliverance from a stronghold, is we need to be wrapped up and we need to put a lot of work on that, because the tendency is going to be to fall back into the old pattern. And we need to be aware that that is the way that we all operate, is we will naturally fall back into the power of that old paradigm. But after we've cursed it, prayed against it, we've got mutual accountability, then we need to be working together to keep each other out of our old stuff. Okay? Now, I want to shift. We have a lot more we could say about strongholds. And again, in the workbook and the materials that we're hoping that you folks will be availing yourselves and using in this series, because you're not going to get this just in one time through. Took me years and years and years and years and a lot of trial and error, and that's reality. I want to shift to some other basic skills in communication now. Transformation requires of us that we learn to master the skill of the distinctive, of the difference between discovering and asserting. Discovering and asserting. Discovery is the act of trying to hear the heart of what somebody else is communicating with you. It's not playing lawyer. Playing lawyer means, you know, but you said, and you cross-examine, and you hang on everybody's words, and we'll talk about that later. But real discovery is, what do you really mean? I mean, I'm not going to hang you that your words weren't right, or your grammar wasn't right, or you might have thrown some wrong words in there. I want to discover, where are you? What are you feeling? What are you seeing? Where are you in this conversation? Now, asserting, on the other hand, is sharing with you what I believe to be true. What I believe to be true. And true communication is an appropriate or proper balance between the right amount of discovery and the right amount of asserting. Now, a practical illustration I can give, and everybody in this room, and I know all the folks that have joined us in this video or audio series, you can all identify with this. How many of you know that listening is not the same thing as waiting to speak? Listening is not the same thing as waiting to speak. And if we're going to have communion, if we're going to go with, if we're going to have communication, we have to stay in the mode of discovery. Now, how do I know when I've dropped out of the mode of discovery? It's because my internal conversation is politely listening to you as you're talking, but I'm not listening to you while you're talking. I dropped out of the conversation at the point where I started my internal response, and I'm just waiting to say what I need to say to you. Which means everything you just said to me, once I decided to talk, I've heard nothing, I've paid no attention, the communication is over. Now, the moment we drop out of the discovery phase, the conversation is over. We now go into a monologue. We now go into the reality of I talk and you prepare to speak. You talk and I prepare to speak. There's no discovery going on. Now, those of you husbands and wives, don't shoot yourself or your spouse. When you get stuck in a conversation, I will guarantee what happened is one or both of you stopped trying to discover where the other person was at and was totally committed to asserting where you're at because you want them to know where you are more than you first want to find out where they are. Now, I experience this all the time. You see this everywhere. You see people talking at each other, but they're not really listening because they're not trying to discover. And again, you know, I didn't begin to understand this stuff, and I'm nearing 60 here. I did not begin to understand this really till the last 10 years or 5 years. And I came from very godly, good parents, loved my parents. Parents were a good example. I should have known this by the time I was 8 years old. Like you may, and some of the folks that are listening to us and going through this series with us, these are the things that we should have been taught by the time we were 10. Because all of life is built on these simple communication skills. Why didn't my mom and dad, who loved me, teach me the difference between discovery and asserting? Because I think about all that I've missed in my relationships because I didn't understand that very, very simple principle. The moment I am done discovering, the communication is over. So in a healthy relationship, in a healthy communication, I'm asserting, you're discovering. You're asserting, I'm discovering. The goal of communication is not to find out who's right and wrong, because then we drop back into a performance-based relationship. The goal of the relationship is to discover each other's heart and to build from there. And I cannot overemphasize how important this distinctive is of knowing that when I'm no longer discovering, I'm no longer listening. The conversation has come to an end. And isn't it funny when we hit the strongholds or the blockages that we have in our relationships? You know, if you had a recording of the conversation, it would be almost identical word for word of conversations you've had 50, 75, 100 times where you said the same thing over and over again, but at some point both parties stopped discovering and you're talking at each other and you're not communicating at all. And then we go back to lesson number one, we get back into the distinctive, the difference between communing, which means going with somebody because you've discovered where they're going, or coercion, which is trying to force somebody, manipulate somebody to go where you want them to go. And coercion does not build a relationship. Okay? All right. Another distinctive we need to understand in communication is that different may not be wrong. This is one of the things that, by the way, when we marry, what I didn't understand when Jan and I got married, you know, 30 plus years ago, was I was marrying into Jan's family and she was marrying into mine. And there were things that we did differently. And different is not necessarily wrong. Now, we Christians, we tend to live in a little false bubble, thinking that our interpretation of right and wrong, which, by the way, may have nothing to do with what the Scriptures say is right and wrong. You know, it's like superimposing culture on Christianity. One of the huge problems that Christians are living with in the 20th and 21st centuries is the fact that when we brought the gospel to different people groups in the world, we superimposed European culture on them rather than superimposing the gospel. Okay? Now, we do that as individuals. We superimpose our personalities, we superimpose our preferences, and then depending upon how much we're caught up in the right-wrong game, we put God's name on it, try and find a Bible verse to justify it, because we're hung up on some really problematical stuff. Different may not be wrong. And I think about humorous things. I'm very much a creature of habit. And Jan probably is more than she knows, but I remember the great battle that we had over me learning how to brush my teeth standing up, because I always brush my teeth bending over the sink. But we had a bathroom that was not big enough for me to brush my teeth bent over, because Jan couldn't get around. And it literally took years for me to come to the place, silly as it is, but it's a good example, where I could stand up, or at least in a modified form, and brush my teeth without me getting angry at Jan, saying, well, if I stand up, you know, I may drip on the sink or whatever. Well, all I had to do was slightly modify the angle of the brushing. But because I'd always, don't you laugh so hard, girl, because I'd always brushed at this angle, to stand up would be wrong. And we get these crazy little habits or crazy views, and I trust that you can learn by my own stupidity. Obviously, there are absolutes. There's gravity. There's the moral and the physical laws of the universe that God has constructed. But, you know, the wonderful thing about the Scriptures, and I wish that we understood this better than we do, lived it more than we do, the Scriptures really address a lot of things, but they leave a lot of things open. Because God is a God of diversity, and preference is okay in some areas, and we need to understand that. If we have the paradigm that different than me is wrong, or different than us is wrong, we got a real problem. And again, in the fallen condition, we tend to want to make things either or that are really both and. I reminded of the scripture there in Acts, where Jesus tells the disciples that they're going to be witnesses both in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the othermost parts. You know, there's something, again, in this performance mentality that we get that makes things either or. Either you do it my way or, you know, you're wrong. Well, there's a lot of times when God gives us a complete permission to do both this way and that way, and unless the Scripture says that either of them is wrong, it's okay. Viva la difference. And we need to come to that kind of reality. And I use the example of brushing the teeth because it's such a simple, stupid, inane example. But so many times we end up fussing and fighting over stupid, little, inane things that have no real meaning, but we attach right and wrong to them. And we need to understand that that may be revealing the stronghold. I want to switch again. Now, this diagram, this circle up there, the whole of me, okay, all of me fits in that circle. And then you've got this little X with a smaller circle there in the bottom. That's called the part of me that we're dealing with. Now, this one I got all the way back in the early 70s when I began to do a lot of extensive counseling. And I came to realize, you know, the light showed on Marblehead, I came to realize that all of us are going to be defensive when a stronghold or something is being corrected, unless we understand that all of us is not being corrected, it's only a part. This is one of the most liberating truths of communication that I think I can possibly share with you, and will make one of the biggest differences in your ability to get through strongholds and hassles with one another. If Adam and I are in a dialogue and we're dealing with something here, and Adam is bringing correction to me, I have to know that all of me is not a total failure. He isn't dealing with me, Dennis, you're a complete wreck, you're a disaster, you know, go out in the garden and eat dirt. We're not into that at all. We're not into condemnation, okay? Where we are is, it is this part of me right now that we're dealing with, so I don't need to defend me. And by the way, I don't want to defend that, because if it's a hindrance to our relationship, hindrance to life, love, reality, God, my destiny, whatever, I want to be the first one to pick out my spiritual pocket knife and excise this thing myself. If I'm on my game, I'm going to have you help me cut it out. Now, I can't cut out my whole self. And we're going to get into this in the next lesson when we talk about the use of words and how we frame words when we're dealing with correction with one another. But we have to be very, very clear that correction is not dealing with the whole of our life. It's dealing with the part that needs to be fixed. Very, very important issue. How many relationships, how many folks right now who are in this living room via film or a tape, How many of their relationships are stuck because one or both parties, when they get into the hassles, when the game is on, I talk about recognizing when the game is on. We're going to deal more with that. You know when the game is on. There's the communication, and all of a sudden the stuff gets a little tense, gets a little excited, blood pressure goes up. Well, baby, the game is on. How many of us, when the game is on, fall into relating to each other as if the whole person needs to be changed rather than, whoa, 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 time out. This is not about the whole of you. This is about that one part right now which is blocking communication or blocking the life that is in our relationship. The last point that I want to make here, because we've already talked about we don't want to get into the right-wrong game, the blame game, all of which reveals that we're in performance, not transformation, is we don't ever want to get in the position, and I know I've done it, and God forgive me as I speak, where we punish people for sharing their hearts. That is one of the most painful things that we can do to another human being. Somebody is vulnerable, they share where they're at, or we ask them, where are you at? They tell us what we don't want to hear. You know, don't ask me if you don't want to hear. But we ask them a question, they tell me what I don't want to hear, and then I emotionally punish them. Now, I may not punish them by slapping your face or kicking your shins or using bad words. I may not play that game. I may just all of a sudden the ice comes on and you feel that person withdraw. You can see it in their eyes, their body language, whatever else. You just crossed a line that you shouldn't have crossed. You shared something with me that came out of your heart, but you really wish you hadn't because you feel me withdrawing. That is one of the most destructive things we can do. I have a teaching I do called Love Runs on Rails. Love runs on rails. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But basically the concept is our love and our trust, we talk about the bridge of trust. The bridge of trust grows by keeping the agreements that we have made. As I break agreements, the bridge of trust falls apart. As I keep agreements, the bridge of trust is strengthened. So that if, again, talking about this bridge of trust, if I ask Todd, if I say, Todd, what did you feel about, you heard me share this morning, or we had a meeting, real time here, jumping out of all this taping and stuff, real time, we had a meeting last night. We had a leaders meeting. I thought an important leaders meeting. And I ask you the question, Todd, what did you think about that leaders meeting? What is there anything I shared that, what was all that? What did you get out of that? And you say, Dennis, I really appreciate you asking me that question. I need to share with you that some of what you said I thought was really inappropriate. And let me tell you some of the feedback I got. Okay? Now you're going to see where our relationship is really at, based on the way that I respond to you sharing your heart, which I ask you to do. But am I going to punish you for doing it? And if I punish you for doing it, Todd, you probably are not going to be very open to sharing your heart with me again. And we cut off the depth of relationship. Well, I want to bring this section to an end, and we're going to do some questions. I know that that's appropriate now. So what have you heard, and what do you want to talk about? Let's talk.
Sometimes with my girlfriend, like, it'll be like the whole, you know, how do you feel about something? And then you kind of tell them. And then all of a sudden, after you've told them, it's the, but you do this. Or the lot of buts, like, but, you know, sometimes this, sometimes that. How come this? And it's almost like when, like, you're trying to tell them to do something. And I do this too. She'll tell me something's wrong, and I'll say, well, but you do this too. What could I do to, like, maybe help that, where it's not so much kind of blaming each other so much and maybe try and get something solved.
Good. Jeff, you know, you're bringing up the whole issue of the blame game and the difference between a transformation-based relationship and a performance-based relationship. And frankly, the best thing you could do is listen to these tapes together or go through this material together and begin to build agreements as to the kind of relationship that you want. One of the agreements being that when you bring correction to me, I don't immediately turn around and say, yes, but you do the same thing. The moment we do that, we've lost the ability to really bring transformation into the situation because we're into the blame. I am defending or deflecting what you're bringing to me by putting it back on you. And, you know, people play various subtle levels of that. Jan and I, and numbers here, lived in the academic community for a while. And it was really a trip watching the academic community play the intellectual, logical, rational, Socratic word games as to how we manipulate with words and esoteric concepts so as to put the blame back on somebody else. Or you can do it on a street level, which is give somebody sign language and pop them in the mouth. It doesn't matter. It's all the same game. It's the relationship is not based on change. The relationship is based on protecting ourselves from having to deal with stuff we don't want to deal with. So seriously, what I'd recommend that you do, I want this to be as real time. We're not doing this just so other people can watch us or hear us, is you need to go through this stuff with your girlfriend. Go ahead, Tom.
You know, this is deep stuff that you're talking about. We're getting knowledge and information that is going to change how we approach relationships, and we're going to understand that relationships are about transformation, not about the blame game, not about performance.
Protecting self.
Right, yeah. Protecting self. So we know this, but a lot of people we interact with don't know it. How could we begin to bring this process into that relationship? I mean, let's say without sitting down and watching this tape.
Yeah, I'm with you.
How could we slowly bring them to that point where they would be interested in seeing a relationship from that perspective?
That's a great question. And the answer, again, a lot of this begins in the sincerity of where we are. So that, let's say, let's play this up. You and I drop out of real time, going to play time here. You know, we're just getting to know each other, and I see that whenever a certain subject comes up, you get defensive, whatever. And then the issue would be for me to be able to say to you, Todd, I really like you, and I want a deeper relationship with you, but there's a hindrance from my point of view that I see happen when I bring this subject up. I feel like you get defensive. And I probably touch you because touch is important. I would make a gesture, a real genuine gesture of contact that I'm your friend. I'm not trying to hurt you. I want to help you. And I want to say to you, Todd, I know that you don't want to be living in blame. And if we're going to have a deeper relationship, we can't talk about blaming each other for this or that or the other thing, nor can we try and defend ourselves. But if we're going to have a deeper relationship, we need to really discover where the other person is at and the way the other person perceives us. And I see you agreeing. And by the way, 99 out of 100 people, if you approach them that way, they're going to agree. And Todd, can I politely, with love for you, can I share there is something in the way that you've responded to me when I bring this up that makes me feel like I can't really get inside you, can't know you the way that I want to know you. Help me. In other words, what I'm doing is I'm appealing to you rather than correcting you. And in the appeal, you feel my vulnerability. And it's when you feel me vulnerable to you rather than trying to change you or put a trip on you, that's going to produce an environment in you and between us where you want to get into the same spirit that you feel going on in me. And that's how we introduce this stuff. And then, again, get skilled enough at these ideas because this stuff pops up every day, all day, in our relationships where you're asking the Holy Spirit, if I can say that, asking the Holy Spirit to show you when you can bring one of these ideas to somebody and, again, put it in the form of appeal that they can hear. Adam.
We've been talking about strongholds and basically coming into conversations where there's interaction and you identify a stronghold. And these sound like pretty intense types of conversations to me. We're talking about dealing with things that are going to elicit emotional reactions, all those sorts of things. And one of the things that I've experienced, and I think all of us have probably seen, is that you can have a very intense conversation with someone where you really, maybe it's very positive, but then the next time you go to interact with them, it's not comfortable anymore. Because you just don't know what to do with all that was surrounding that emotionally and all of that. We've talked about the bridge of trust earlier.
Yes.
What are some things that we could do that can help the relationship continue to grow and not, because of the intensity of that one conversation, all of a sudden become very difficult?
Yeah, that is not only a great question, but a true observation that all of us have experienced. The only thing I can say is, out of my experience, and it's similar to what I just shared with Todd, is what destroys relationships are the things that we can't talk about. And the last thing we want to do when we come back together and we're feeling the weird trip, as in, boy, we got naked, so to speak, spiritually or emotionally, and we shared all that, and boy, I don't know what to do, I'm feeling weird, is we need to talk about that. We need to get the unspoken discomfort up on the table. And we need to learn to get comfortable in talking about the experience in such a way that we're able to deal with it in a positive way. And I know that I need to bring this to an end. I know more stuff we need to talk about and will in the next session. But again, I want to invite those of you that have joined us and joined in this living room discussion that's real time. I hope that you're aware of this, that your relationships can be revolutionized. They can be radically changed in applying these principles. And we're hoping, we want to urge you, sincerely urge you, to take the time to look up the website, go after the phone number, pursue this information, because it has the power to change your marriage, change your family, change your organization, your business, change your generational relationships, your racial relationships. It has the power to break strongholds, and that is what is going to take your life to another level. I'm Dennis Peacock, and if you're enjoying and getting life out of what you see going on here in this living room, and there is life in this living room, I want to encourage you to communicate with us. Check out our website, call the numbers. We have the materials that will allow you to study the information and become a facilitator, a trainer, whatever you want to call it, where you would be able to facilitate this kind of a teaching in your home, your neighborhood, where you work, etc. We call these transformation study groups, and I trust the reason for the name is obvious. Check us out on that website. Get the materials. Not only can this change your life, you can be used to spread a relational revolution, if you will, that will bring real change to the lives of your family, your friends, your people in church, or people that don't know God if you're a Christian. Join us in Let's Talk. It does make a difference. My background, you've asked about my background. Born in Seattle, Washington. Probably the most definitive thing about me at that point was I was an athlete. Grew up with a whole identity of being an athlete. Tried out for the Olympics in 1960 while I was a junior in high school in the decathlon, and had a whole vision, and a lot of people thought I would fulfill it, of winning a gold medal in the Olympics in the decathlon. I was a sprinter and a pole vaulter, state champion pole vaulting, state of Washington twice, and the national decathlon leader in high school. Went to Berkeley in 1961 on a football track scholarship. Again, my identity was tied up in all that. I got injured my sophomore year and went through a major identity crisis in Berkeley. Berkeley was a heck of a place to have an identity crisis in the early 60s. I was a sprinter. I was, as I say, one of the few white guys that could run with the brothers. And that had a major effect on my life, because when the civil rights movement came along and I really began to develop a social conscience, I got very much involved, obviously, in the civil rights movement. I majored in political theory at Berkeley and graduated in 1966. I had been taking graduate studies at that time as well, and became disillusioned with the whole academic intellectual community. I had thrown myself into the academic world with the same intensity that I had, you know, in terms of the athletics. There was a point for about 2 years I described myself as a born-again Marxist. I wasn't a communist, but I was really, really believed in dialectical materialism, and of course was involved in a periphery way with the formation of the New Left, not as a leader, but more as a grunt. I was arrested in the free speech movement there at Berkeley in December 1964 with about 860 other people, and that was all about the Freedom Riders being recruited there on the Berkeley campus. I became disillusioned with the whole political approach to life, recognizing that the changes that were required were greater than simple social engineering or economic engineering could produce. and I went towards the East. I figured if the West didn't have the answers, the East would. I got involved heavily in drugs, smoked a lot of marijuana and psychedelics, and again came to a point where I couldn't get beyond a certain level of growth. As I said, I dropped out of the graduate studies, ran a pool hall on Telegraph Avenue for a while, and then took a job as a research economist with the state AFL-CIO for a couple of years. I did public utility rate regulation, lobbying, and basic economic research. I met my wife, Jan, who we've been together now 35 years. She was one of the students. I was a reader, TA in the speech department at Berkeley. Met her. We got involved in the middle of all this period. I had a conversion experience with Christ in December of 1967, which played itself out later on in 68. We stopped the flower business, Jan and I. As I said a moment ago, I became disillusioned with the intellectual stuff, went to the East, worked, at the Labor Federation, and became very, very depressed relative to what I saw going on in the culture. You know, I feel like to some degree I really am a child of the 60s. I went through drugs, sex, and rock and roll and the whole nine yards, became disillusioned and found myself singing, "Is That All There Is?" At that point, I had an experience with Jesus Christ in a very, very personal way. And one of the things that I said to the Lord was, "If you love me, don't make me a Christian." Because I didn't think Christians had guts. I knew that if I became a Christian, a couple of negative things could happen to me. I could get emasculated. I'd probably have a lobotomy. I wouldn't be able to think. I wouldn't be involved in social action. All the things that meant something to me and were a part of my background seemed to be denied the possibility in Christianity. But obviously, they're there. But it took a while to find them. And Jan, we got the flower company started. And Jan and I began our walk together in the Lord, which has been an amazing experience. You can imagine coming from an existentialist, Marxist, political theorist, activist, drug, sex, rock and roll, Zen, Buddhist, martial arts, all the stuff I was into when I came to Christianity. There wasn't a whole lot of Christians that could relate to me or the crowd that I was running with. So we ended up actually starting our own churches in a couple of years. I went into that process where I actually built a church with other leaders for about 7 or 8 years. I was eventually sent out of that as a teacher or a prophetic voice out into other church communities around the country and eventually around the world. And really for about the last 25 years, I've been traveling around the world working with political leaders on Christian economics, business people on the application of biblical truth to business, working with pastors on building local churches, and generally being a troublemaker in the kingdom of God. I still remain to some degree outside the mainstream because the hunger that God put inside me for real transformation and real Christianity, not social or cultural Christianity, but the real deal that I see in the book and that was in the lives of those men and women that turned the world right side up, that's what I'm after. And I started the journey that way when I was out of Christ because he made me that way. That's where I am now. And those are the kinds of people that I'm looking for, is the people that want the real deal, the real change, the real transformation, and are willing to pay the price because there is a price to get there.
This is a copyrighted program of Rebuild and Dominion Enterprises. Unauthorized duplication is prohibited. Strategic Christian Services offers a wide variety of other educational materials and training schools designed to help you live life to its fullest. For more information on our products and services, please call us at 1-800-700-0605. Join us online at www.gostrategic.org or write to us at Post Office Box 2709, Santa Rosa, California, 95405.